Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We'll be talking media again today, and it's a live show. We've had a couple recorded shows the past 2 weeks, and I think if you've looked at our schedule and if you've subscribed to our weekly email we send out, you're expecting to hear David Barsami on today, and John Nichols is to be our guest next week. We've done a little juggling due to schedule problems, and we're going to have John Nichols as our guest today, and hopefully we'll get David Barsami on back on there next week, as we promised. John Nichols has been on Media Matters. I think he was one of our very first guests, if not our first guest, and he's also been on another show as well. He's a frequent guest of ours. He is one of the leading political journalists in the United States, writing for The Nation magazine. He's written widely on media and media issues. He's also a daily newspaper editorial page writer in Madison, Wisconsin, where he lives. And he's joining us today very graciously on short notice from his home in Madison. John, are you there?
I am here, Bob, and it's great to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you join us. We're really pleased. And I know that one of the beats you cover for The Nation and that you cover for the Capital Times, the paper you work for in Madison, is the national electoral political scene. And we're coming upon now midterm elections that will take place for Congress that will determine really the control of both the House and the Senate. The Senate now is just a one-vote divide. Actually, technically, it's a 50-49 Senate at this point.
Yeah, with one independent who votes with the Democrats.
And everything is really up for grabs, and much of the course of what's going to happen politically in this country in the next 2 years will be determined by the outcome of these races. You've been on the road. You've been around. What can you report for us?
Well, I can report, and very apropos of the show, that the national media has done a terrible job of covering what is really broadly accepted in Washington as the most critical election fight in recent American history. This is the battle year that will define whether George W. Bush and the Republicans have complete control of both the executive and the legislative branch, or whether there will be a Democratic opposition in either one or both houses of Congress. And out in America, the fights in various states are complicated by the fact that so much of the fall's media coverage has been on the debate about Iraq and more broadly on sort of international affairs issues. And there's been very little focus on economic issues. So it's a real struggle on the ground. I think a lot of people have yet to tune into a lot of races. When they do, and as they do, they're going to find that this is an incredibly intense year with both control of the House and the Senate very much up for grabs. I think that we're seeing a lot of issues in play that I think national pundits might not be so aware of, but on the ground people are very conscious of, most significantly, a dramatically slowing economy, which has caused people in a lot of places to get, frankly, quite scared about what's going to happen after the election, not overseas in Iraq, but in their hometowns where there are a lot of layoffs and other economic problems coming into play.
You know, I noticed this morning, speaking of the economy, that the front page of the National New York Times edition, above the fold, had a major story on exactly that topic, that the economy just is not taking off. This is what they're calling a W-shaped recession. Pun intended, I guess.
I think so, yeah.
If Democrats say it, pun intended, unintended for Republicans. But that it looks like the foreseeable quarter, 6 months, year of the economy does not look especially good.
No, that's exactly right. And frankly, you have to go back to the start of the year. The Republicans have known for a long time that this was going to be their biggest risk in the fall of 2002. Karl Rove gave a speech in January where he said if the fall election is about corporate accountability issues and the economy, the Democrats will gain control of the House and retain control of the Senate. On the other hand, if the debate is about overseas issues, foreign affairs, particularly national security in Iraq, the Republicans have a chance of winning. And that's really what we've seen happen over the late summer, early fall. It's been a tremendous struggle by the Bush administration to make Iraq the central issue of the fall, the thing that everybody's talking about, rather than economic issues, which are, frankly, much more pressing on the ground around the U.S. It's a real classic clash between Washington spinmeisters and the media that tends to follow them, and the grassroots and the reality of what's going on out in America. And it's made this fall's election fights very confusing and complicated. This is one of the most uncertain, unpredictable election years we've seen in a long time.
You know, some people have argued, in fact, I had Barbara Ehrenreich as a guest about 6 weeks ago on the air here on Media Matters. Some people have argued that the push for war in Iraq, the timing, has as much to do with domestic political concerns, like the ones you just mentioned that Karl Rove had stated, as they do with international changes. Nothing necessarily has changed that much in Iraq, but the big change is there's an election coming up and there's an economy that's heading south.
I think that's exactly true, and it's something that you see as you go around the country. There are places where there's no question that the economy has slowed terribly, and really ought to be the primary debate. It's what people ought to be talking about, and yet you've seen that debate pulled over toward dialogue about Iraq. And let's be clear, it is not just the Republicans that are pulling it over there. When the Bush administration put Iraq on the table, you saw a lot of grassroots folks, progressive folks all over the country, you know, rise up as activists and say, no, 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 we don't want to go to war. And so you've seen, you know, both sides focus in on that issue. And unluckily, I think, for the polity, really, you know, the kind of core debate that should be going on, it has drawn the engaged and activist people, both on the left and the right, into a foreign policy debate that has very little grounding in reality. I mean, there's no intelligence evidence to suggest that Iraq is a greater threat today than it was 2 years ago. In fact, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Bob Graham, voted against the resolution to give the president increased power, war-making powers, saying, you know, there's just no rationale for this. But be that as it may, both sides are very focused on that debate, and there's much less energy going into a dialogue about, again, corporate accountability, economic issues. And to be honest, you can blame the Bush administration. They certainly have worked hard to make this the case. But you also have to blame national Democrats, who I think have handled the issue remarkably ineptly.
We're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters, and if you'd like to call in and ask John Nichols a question, we do have lines open, and John, you will find, can talk about anything concerning politics in America today. The phone number locally is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. I'm Bob McChesney, your host of Media Matters. John, you know, this year we had campaign finance reform passed, if I'm not mistaken.
In the form of the McCain-Feingold bill.
Yeah, and you know, everyone's been talking for years about how horrible the situation is in political campaigns. They cost so much, and you know, this bill is supposed to take care of the problem. Now, it doesn't kick in for this election cycle, does it?
No, it doesn't. In fact, one of the final compromises in the campaign finance reform debate was to create a starting date for the reform of one day after the 2002 election.
Mm-hmm.
It starts November 6th.
Okay. And as I understand it, what the law does is it gets rid of what's called soft money.
Mm-hmm.
And that soft money is the sort of money that comes from labor unions and big business and PACs, as they're called, and it's sort of generic money that doesn't go specifically to a candidate. Explain that to me, if you would.
Well, the McCain-Feingold bill was initially a genuine campaign finance reform bill. It, over many years, was compromised down to a targeted reform that took out one type of money, and that is soft money. Soft money is the money that powerful interests dump in mainly to political parties for use in advertising campaigns generally that attack opposition candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And you can identify those ads pretty easily. They're usually the worst ads on TV, the kind that are the most vicious attack ads, and often end with a so-called issue-oriented message, like, you know, call such and such and tell them you think they're a dirty, rotten rat.
Ask them why he's still molesting children.
Exactly. And, you know, it really is the kind of dark underside of politics, because soft money is not accountable. Corporations can give as much as they want to a political party, and then it can be doled out into the races around the country by the party with the exact same effect as if the corporations had given the money to candidates, but without the contribution ever showing up on the candidate's campaign contribution list.
Now, since the soft money ban will go in effect after this election, this, I've been reading it in the trade press, in the broadcasting industry trade press, there's sort of a huge, you know, sort of last-minute get-in-under-the-deadline rush for powerful special interests to sort of get their soft money into the two political parties right now, just load them up with enough money to grease them up for the next decade.
That is absolutely true, and it's, and we're seeing it, the spending going on like wild in this year's race. This year, there will be as much, probably more money spent on television advertising than in the 2000 presidential race. And the amount of money that's flying around is just incredible. It isn't just to load the parties up with money for the next decade. It is also to help the parties, to gain favor with the parties and to establish structures that even when the soft money ban comes in, corporate interests will find other routes to have influence. And so rest assured that the broadcasters, as well as the political parties, are ambitiously coming up with ways to get around this new structure. And my sense is that despite McCain-Feingold, we're going to see campaigns go on pretty much as they have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the tragedies of our politics. And again, it feeds into something that you've talked about before, and I think we've talked about on this show some, and we're certainly seeing it in play this year. There is a very dark conspiracy, and I hate to use that word, but there's no other term for it, between the political parties, special interests, and the broadcasters in this country to create a circumstance where a lot of money flows through the parties and through various different issue, quote-unquote issue campaigns, into television advertising. The end result is that we get a politics that is driven by 30-second attack ads rather than serious news coverage of what's going on. In fact, we actually have had instances where broadcasters have said, you know, we don't have to cover elections anymore because people get their information from the ads.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the research has shown over the past decade that increasingly what's happened is that traditional broadcast media have stopped covering campaigns for all intents and purposes and replaced them with these expensive 30-second ads on one hand. In print journalism, to the extent it does cover campaigns, still increasingly is reduced to covering the spin, almost like what's the tactical strategy going on with the candidate rather than sort of substantive issues.
Well, you'll see that all over the country. In fact, you're down there in central Illinois or east central Illinois.
There you go.
And you've got a congressional race down there where, by all accounts, you've got a very strong Republican incumbent, and the Democratic candidate appears to have kind of just taken a walk on the race. You've got a thoughtful green candidate who really is trying to raise issues and do things, and yet most of the media in that region is writing off the green candidate as, you know, irrelevant, not because he happens to be green, but because he is, you know, not well-funded.
He's not buying ads on their stations.
Well, yeah, and it goes to this game now where we see it all over the country. Credible candidates who certainly ought to get a hearing, and in any Democratic, small-d Democratic system would, are X'd out of the process at the beginning by a media that says, you know, look, you haven't raised a lot of money, you're not buying a lot of ads, so you can't possibly be a credible candidate. The standard of credibility has been defined as the ability to, you know, buy the most 60-second commercials.
I think you're absolutely right. That explains why Ross Perot gets taken seriously. Even Donald Trump was taken somewhat seriously, whereas Ralph Nader wasn't. One of them could go in and write checks to buy, you know, primetime slots, and the other couldn't.
And it plays out right down into the primary process, so that we see the winners of Democratic and Republican primaries more and more being exceptionally wealthy individuals who just simply decide after, you know, 30-year career in business, now I want to be a senator. Or very candidates who are very closely tied to special interests and thus can raise a lot of money from a particular interest grouping.
And after being in politics, they'll become wealthy.
Yeah, well, indeed. And even if they don't, you know, look, having a career in Congress is something that a lot of people would like to do. And if you are given entree to that career, by a huge infusion of special interest money, you are by your nature going to owe a high level of loyalty to those special interests. The bottom line, though, is that again and again around the country, we see a circumstance where the wealthy or the chosen candidates of the wealthy become the nominees of the major parties and are the only people treated seriously as contenders, whereas working people and folks who really have a lot to offer this process are X'd out of it.
We're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in and ask John a question, our telephone number is 333-9455 locally, and our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. John, we've already got a few callers in. Let's go right to the phone lines. Line one, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I was really interested in your comments about Karl Rove and his speech from last January, I believe, in which he laid out his description of what he was hoping the election would be about. And I'm wondering, how has it been possible that having such a prominent person make a speech like that 9 or 10, 11 months before the election, in which he pretty much says, we have to construct the situation so that it's essentially the election is not about the economy. How is it that the collective media in the United States then falls in line and helps change the debate such that the debate no longer becomes it's not even possible that the debate is about the economy?
Mm-hmm.
It then becomes a debate that's exactly about what Karl Rove said he wanted it to be about. How is that possible?
Caller, I'm going to ask you to hang up now because our lines are full and I'm going to let other people get in. Then, John, you can listen to John's answer
great.
Off it.
Okay? Great, thank you.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, John, that's a great question. Why? How can Karl Rove work this sort of magic to sort of be the assignment editor of our news media?
Well, it's not magic, my friend. It's actual, just old-fashioned political spin. That's all Rove's about. The problem is in the transformation of our media. We used to have a media not that long ago that took a certain pride in questioning spin and in challenging people in power. And that's no longer the case. Most of our media, in Washington especially, practices what can best be referred to as stenography to power. They literally go to official sources and say, well, what's the official line today? And then they publish that or they broadcast that. And it's the collapse of what ought to be the most necessary element in journalism, which is skepticism.
Yeah,
Rove made that speech. That should have sent the flags up. Every journalist in the country should have been watching for the attempt to scam the system by raising an issue like Iraq.
Now, what responsibility...
It doesn't happen.
John, what responsibility do the other official sources besides the Republicans, the Democrats, have for not, you know, being more aggressive here and really pushing journalists on this, or were they really powerless?
No, they do bear some responsibility, because in a system where media is no longer skeptical, and that is certainly the case, and also where media is afraid to do any kind of independent analysis, the only way you get a debate in mainstream media in America today is if the two political parties take opposing stances. What happened in the Iraq debate was that when the Bush administration did what Karl Rove said it would do, i.e., raised a national security issue just in time for the fall elections, instead of being a party of opposition that challenged the White House, the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate, Dick Gephardt and Tom Daschle, went right along with the White House. Not only did they vote most recently for the resolution on Iraq, but they also, from the start of it, sort of bent to cooperate with and actually help draft the legislation. That made it impossible for an incompetent media, which is frankly what we have, to figure out how to cover the issue. So what you get is these absurd headlines that say there's overwhelming support for the Bush policy on Iraq. That isn't even true in Congress. A third of the members of Congress in the House voted against the resolution.
Mm-hmm.
But the media reporters in D.C. are not even serious enough about it to go beyond the leadership level and look into the ranks of the actual congressional delegations.
John, I'm delighted to say that our listeners share the same enthusiasm for what you had to say that I have. Our phone lines are totally full, so let's whip right through the calls here. Line two, you're on the air with John Nicholson. Thank you very much for your patience.
Yeah, well, I'll try to be brief, too. It's hard. I wanted to start off with the discourse about the war. And there was an implied critique that, you know, opposition people, people who are opposed to the war are sort of being duped into changing the subject. And it's the media basically pigeonholes opposition to being just anti-war. But if you start reading just even some of the placards that are held, there's a more thoroughgoing critique there. They wanted to report. It's against the military-industrial complex. It's against the supposed addiction to oil. So there is a wider critique that isn't that I don't think that. I mean, we need to be more clever to get it into the discourse. But the media doesn't want to talk about that part of the opposition to the war, particularly. They just, you know, some people are just pacifists, but most people, I think, have a more thoroughgoing critique. But that is never allowed to surface, and that ties the two together: the fact that the military-industrial complex has, you know, Rummy in at the Secretary of War position. You know, he's been pushing high-tech stuff for a long time, the head of the Space Commission. But I wanted to get back to something that you specific thing you said, and maybe I missed it, but Graham voted against the resolution because he said it wasn't strong enough. He wanted to add six more terrorist groups. Maybe that was, that's what I heard him say. Maybe.
Actually, he didn't vote against it. He criticized it for not being strong enough, but he actually ended up, you're talking about Bob Graham.
You were talking the head of the Senate Intelligence,
yes,
which is the senator from Florida, and I believe he, yes, voted against it, saying it wasn't strong enough. And I heard.
Well, that's unluckily that's sort of the creepy Washington spin coming in. Behind the scenes, Graham was highly critical. He said, "Look, there's no intelligence basis for this." He made an attempt to undermine the Bush position by saying, "Well, if you're going to do this, you ought to talk about a whole bunch of other places." It was
a good contribution to the discussion, though.
No, it was no contribution, let's be clear. The only reason I bring Graham up is, so folks who may not have been following the issue as closely as you are will recognize that the person who has the most access to intelligence information in the Senate voted against this bill. You would think that if there really was a pressing threat from Iraq, that it really wasn't an immediate threat that we had to respond to, the head of the Intelligence Committee would have voted for it.
Point taken. I will defer to the rest of the callers. Thanks. I do have something else to say, but I'll
thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I want to thank all the other callers who have been sort of very patient on the lines. I will get to you all. Please keep your position. We do have one line open now. John, one quick thing to follow up on that before we go to the next caller. I mean, he touched, I think, on some very good points. There are certain sort of basic issues on the Iraq debate that sort of never really surface. The one you just made, I think, that sort of showed up a little bit on the margins, that the intelligence community itself really doesn't buy into the claims of the administration with regard to the Iraqi threat.
No, not at all. In fact, it's interesting that Anthony Zinni, who is President Bush's chosen representative on the Middle East peace process, the guy who's been running all over Israel and Palestine and trying to sort things out there, has said, this is a terrible idea. It will destabilize the region. It shouldn't be done. And the problem, and the caller points to something else that's very critical. He said, you know, look, the anti-war movement is a much more nuanced, much more sophisticated movement than is communicated in the media. That is so totally true. The fact of the matter is that we have seen the media reduce the reaction of the American people to this debate to a very simplistic, you know, are you for us or against us type of debate. But as somebody who goes out and actually interviews a lot of American people and travels across the country a lot, I've been in more than a dozen states in the last month, I find that average Americans have very nuanced, very intelligent critiques of this whole process. They don't like Saddam Hussein, and if a pollster asks them, do you think that Saddam Hussein should be, you know, knocked out of power in Iraq, they'll say, yeah, sure, I'm all for that. But then if you ask them, well, do you think the U.S. should go it alone in a unilateral preemptive war without the support of the Europeans and in a situation that might destabilize the Middle East, you suddenly find that, you know, average Americans are very dubious.
Mm-hmm.
And our media, again, with a highly unsophisticated coverage of the national debate and the kind of grassroots response of the American people, has totally lost that nuance.
We're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a few callers waiting to get in there. I promise I'm going to go right to all three of you right now. There still is one line open. The local number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Right now, we're going to line four, Homewood, Illinois. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah, hello. I appreciate the show very much. One anecdote, one question. Short time ago, I was visiting with my relatives down in central Illinois, who have been conservative Republicans for all my life and all my memory, and they're very much against it. And we asked them, what about their friends? And they say, we're very much against Bush's policies in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So then a few days ago, there was a Georgie Ann Geyer piece where she was saying that if you interview Middle America, you'll find out that they're reflecting what my relatives are saying, that they're not supporting the administration and its Middle Eastern policies. But then on the other hand, you hear about these polls, and I think you alluded to one where there were 60% in favor of what Bush is doing on his foreign policy. Are you saying that it's just we're not getting the right media, the media's not giving us the right information, they're not questioning enough?
Absolutely. I think it's a twofold thing. Number one, the media certainly has not brought an appropriate level of skepticism to this debate. And we see a real big problem in our national media where it's sort of divided between the outright cheerleaders for the Bush administration view, that would be your Fox network, and those who claim to be giving an unbiased, impartial interpretation. But that essentially means that they just don't cheerlead when they report only the administration line. What we really ought to have is a media, not big radical media per se, but a media more equivalent to what you see in Great Britain. Most of the British newspapers and certainly the BBC have offered a much more nuanced, much more sophisticated analysis of both the Iraqi threat and domestic responses to it in Great Britain. And the interesting thing is that in Great Britain, polls across the board show a clear and well-understood opposition to Tony Blair's efforts to go along with George W. Bush. In fact, the opposition is so strong that it's caused Blair to really step back from his kind of outright support for the Bush line into a more cautious approach. And I think we'd have the exact same response here in America if our media reported the issues and analyzed them with the same level of sophistication that the British media does. I really do believe that we have a media-created mess.
You know, John, if I can follow up on the caller's point, it strikes me, and I've only seen this on the margins that it's been talked about, that this war in Iraq is really a departure from traditional notions of foreign policy, whatever one might think of them, that the United States has had for the past 50 years or so, but sort of the unilateral nature of it, and that there's nothing so-called conservative about it. I mean, traditional conservatives in this country have been very skeptical of the sort of world governance that the United States is proposing to undertake here, as I understand traditional conservatism.
I think that's exactly true. And the interesting thing is that, if you think of a conservative as perhaps being someone, like Richard Nixon and other people used to refer to strict constructionists, people who actually take the Constitution seriously,
mm-hmm.
they couldn't possibly support what happened this last week in Congress. Because the Congress, basically driven by political motivations, I think, both on the part of Republicans who want to support their president and Democrats who are afraid of the issues, parlayed away their constitutionally dictated responsibility to advise and consent in matters of war and peace. There is simply no question that as Robert Byrd argued very strongly, this Congress should have held tightly to its responsibility to determine whether we should go to war or not. The president could go to Congress anytime he wants with solid evidence and say, look, now we have to fight. The president has the power also to respond to an actual attack. But This wasn't about either of those things.
Yeah.
This was about a president going to Congress and saying, I want a blank check to launch a preemptive attack against a country that may not even pose a threat to the United States.
I want to let line three in Eureka know. I'm going to get to you in a second, but I want to go to line two first. Is there on a cell phone in the highway? Line two, are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay, John Nichols is awaiting your question or comment.
I tend to agree, and more than tend, I fully agree with the critique of the media. What I don't understand is what is the structure of the media that makes this possible? That is, who is directing the orientation of the media to follow this line, this non-critical line? What is it about who is calling the shots to lead writers, whether op-ed or reporting, editorial, whatever, to take this non-critical line?
Okay, I'm going to hang up the phone and let John answer for you, caller. Yeah, John?
I think the answer to that question is actually one that most Americans will well understand. All they have to do is turn their televisions on, and they get a good sense of it. As our media has become more conglomerated, as we've had fewer and fewer companies controlling more and more of our broadcast and print media, there are tremendous pressures to return huge profits for investors. I mean, media is no longer driven by editors and journalists. It's driven by investors and CEOs. And that pressure causes media companies to encourage their journalists, in fact, even demand that their journalists go to sort of a lowest common denominator reporting. Instead of spending the money to do serious investigative reporting and a lot of international coverage, as, say, the BBC does, American media companies are pushed to do a lot more weather coverage, a lot more feature coverage, a lot more non-controversial, non-skeptical news, quote-unquote, reporting or coverage with an eye toward really making sure that people like you rather than that people are informed by you. And that has caused a real transition in the diet, if you will, of news, that plate of coverage that people get. A lot of controversial stories, a lot of international stories that citizens in a democracy need to know about in order to make informed judgments have been pushed off the plate to be replaced by, 7 or 8 minutes of weather coverage on your local evening news and, huge amounts of what are essentially advertising, quote-unquote, newscasts. I mean, things about, kind of lifestyle issues, exercise issues, things of that nature, which people could find out about without having it come through the, quote-unquote, news format.
We're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple lines open, and we've got about 20 minutes to go, so please call in at 333-9455. Or the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And right now, let's go to line three from Eureka, Illinois. Thank you for your supreme patience.
Well, thank you. This is an excellent program, and your guest is a great, great breath of fresh air. I have two short questions. This morning on C-SPAN, they were talking about the current 2002 cycle, and it was mentioned that the Democrat gubernatorial candidate in Texas had already spent something like $50 million, maybe going up to $70. Could your guest confirm that or know anything more about it?
Well, it looks like we could get to those numbers. I don't know that you'll get quite up to 70, but it's clear that the Democratic candidate for governor down in Texas, Tony Sanchez, just bought his way into the nomination and has bought his way into competitiveness in the fall. He's much like the recently elected senator from New Jersey, John Corzine, who spent about $70 million in his race as well.
Corzine's a native Illini, you should know.
He is indeed.
A second question is, I had heard a couple times that in the either 1998 or 2000 a year election cycle for the House that I believe 100 out of the 435 candidates for the House of Representatives were running unopposed. Could you confirm that, and is that number anything like that in this current election cycle?
Yes, it's an absolute parallel pattern that you have a huge number of candidates running unopposed. And more significantly than that, though, and look at an even worse number. Of the 435 congressional races, House races in the U.S. this year, it is safe to say that about 380 to 400 of them are non-competitive, i.e., it's already clear who will win those contests because of a combination of redistricting that favors one party or another and campaign finance structures that make it virtually impossible to challenge an entrenched incumbent.
I saw a speech, John, recently by Michael Moore in which he was talking about how he'd seen that there was a 98% return rate in the U.S. Congress after between the last couple of elections. 98% of the people who wanted to run again were reelected. And he said that he had someone go look it up, and he found out that under Stalin, there was a higher turnover rate in the Politburo in the Soviet Union. It's like 94% return rate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's be clear. The United States does not have anything equivalent to a functional democratic structure going on. If you were to start a country and say, you know, look, we really want to have a politics and a governance that reflects the sentiments of the people, you would never establish a system like we have, the combination of allowing the politicians to draw their own district lines and then overlaying it with a campaign finance system that's driven entirely by special interest money. No, I mean, it guarantees that you get a Congress that does not reflect the actual sentiments of the people.
Yeah, to interrupt you, John, but in Wisconsin, your home state, when they redrew the congressional map after they had to lose a seat after the 2000 census, as I understand it, they redrew the map in such a way basically to make sure there would be no competitive races, that the incumbents are set for the next decade.
Yeah, and that's not just Wisconsin. I mean, that's all over the country. In state after state, there is simply no competitive politics. Look at the state of Massachusetts, and that's a state where all of the members of Congress are Democrats. And yet, 40% of the people in Massachusetts regularly vote Republican. Now, so you have a situation in Massachusetts where, despite the fact that 2 out of every 5 voters want one party to be represented, all of the representatives are from the other party. And you see a similar play out in a state like Kansas, you know, where you have the overwhelming, you have about 40% Democratic voters, and yet the overwhelming majority of the congressional representation is Republican.
John Nichols, we have a very patient caller on line one. Urbana, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah, thanks. I'll make a comment and a question. I was wondering, you were mentioning about the European opinion, and I just wanted to add that apparently there's a large contingent there who connects 9/11 itself to our ill-conceived foreign policies.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't get any play over here. I vote green, but here's my question. I vote green myself, but in this national fight over the control of Congress, I was wondering if any Green Party candidates seem willing to cut deals to drop out, essentially, with the Democrats just to avoid a Republican Congress. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think that takes us to a place I wanted to ask you about, which is the Senate race in Minnesota with Paul Wellstone up for re-election.
Sure. And we can talk specifically about Minnesota in a sec, but to give the broader response to the caller's question, the fact is that the Greens have in many states, despite what you hear from, you know, some Democratic Party spin, have acted very responsibly. They have refused to challenge Democratic candidates in close races quite often and have actually stepped back from challenging Democrats who have been outspoken in, say, opposition to the war or in other progressive positions. Dennis Kucinich, for instance, in the Cleveland area, has no green opponent. Tammy Baldwin, who's Kucinich's ally on anti-war issues, has no green opponent. Again and again around the country, you see that the Greens have actually practiced a pretty sophisticated politics that doesn't always play out. In Minnesota, the Greens did mount a challenge to Paul Wellstone. There is a Green Party candidate on the November ballot up there what is a very tight race between Wellstone, the quite progressive Democratic candidate, and Norm Coleman, a Bush-selected Republican candidate, a guy who's just completely in the pocket of the White House. And I think that in cases like that, the voters are actually to be trusted. My sense is that I find it hard to imagine that anybody's going to walk into the polling place and say, well, I'm a progressive, and, you know, I'm not totally satisfied with Paul Wellstone, even though he's, you know, he's with me about 80-90% of the time, so I'm going to vote green. I just don't see that happening. I think the minimal number of votes that the Greens get in Minnesota will come almost entirely from folks who wouldn't have voted, either wouldn't have voted anyway or wouldn't have voted for Wellstone anyway. So I don't see the Greens draining things off there at all. And the flip of it is, I think in some some gubernatorial races, the Greens are posing a really valuable and needed alternative. I look especially at California, where Governor Gray Davis has really governed as you know, essentially a Republican in Democrats' clothing on many, many issues, very tied to the special interests. And the Green candidate out there, Peter Camejo, is polling at 8 or 9%, maybe even 10% in some surveys. And, you know, I think that's a very healthy candidacy because it is providing an alternative for voters who are disgusted with a Democrat who's sold out a lot of what were thought to be Democratic principles.
Well, I think that's going back to the point of departure, John. If you've got a situation where out of 435 seats in the House, for example, 350 to 400 aren't being contested by one of the two major parties, well, there's 350 or 400 places where there's a place for a third party to come in and say, we're going to offer an alternative.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what's happened. And at this point, though, I mean, let's be clear. I don't think this is going to be a particularly good year for the Greens. It does not look like they've got any congressional candidates who are actually going to win or any gubernatorial candidates who are going to win in these sort of high-profile races. And beyond that, I do think that the Bush administration is genuinely the biggest challenge for our green politics in this country. President Bush and his administration moved so many issues so far to the right that even though the Democratic Party has not provided much in the way of credible opposition, to my view, an immense number of progressive voters are going to go with the Democrats simply out of fear of how much further things could go to the right if you had a Republican-controlled Congress.
And I think this leads then to the question of 2004 and a run for president as either a Green or even a progressive in the Democratic Party with the sort of financial needs it takes to run now, to run for president,
mm-hmm.
And the sort of press coverage that certainly Nader got in 2000. What's your thinking about the 2004 presidential race? Do you think the Greens will do anything? Do you think there's going to be a fiercely contested battle on the Democratic side? What's your sense right now?
Well, I think that the Greens probably will run in 2004. Again, I always go to the point of I tend to trust the voters on these things. I think a Green candidacy will only get as far as the Democrats allow it to get, i.e., if the Democrats nominate Joe Lieberman or some other very conservative candidate who is essentially in agreement with the Bush administration on a lot of military and economic issues, then whoever the Green candidate is, they will have a level of viability that is dramatically increased. And that is because voters will make the common sense judgment that the Democrats are not really posing an opposition. By the same token, if Democrats nominate a more progressive candidate, I think you'll see the Green vote temp down. For the exact same reasons, voters will recognize that there's a credible opposition on the Democratic line. So really the critical fight becomes for the Democratic nomination. And what we see is that Dennis Kucinich, who we've talked about before on this show, the leader of congressional opposition to the war in Iraq and also a very outspoken opponent of corporate globalization, really head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and a guy who has established himself as a true opponent of the Bush administration, is looking seriously at mounting a primary challenge. If he does that, I think you could see a real coalescence of progressives and even many Greens around that challenge. And that's, I mean, frankly, if Democrats are smart, they will look for a candidate who really is a credible opponent to the Bush administration and not a pale kind of shadow of the Bush administration. That's going to be what the fight for the Democratic nomination is about. And it's not just Kucinich. There are other people who could pose that credible opposition. But frankly, Kucinich is the one who at this point seems to be edging toward a candidacy that really would, I think, be quite exciting.
We're talking to John Nichols today in Media Matters. We've got about 8 minutes left. If you'd like to call in, we've got a couple lines open. The local number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. And now we're going to go to a very patient caller. Line 4, Cook County, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi. Mr. Nichols made some comments before on the diagnosis of our problem with the media, and I would just like him to extend those to NPR. For example, he brought out that there's an abundance of lifestyle issues, terrific shortage of long critical pieces of the issues at hand, and so on. We see that, as he said, in the concentrated commercial broadcasting, but I would like him to either explain why we see it also in NPR or make the case that NPR is a grade better. Thanks a lot, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, caller.
That's a great question. To my view, NPR is better than commercial broadcast media. The question is not, you know, one of, you know, well, let me put it this way. It is better in my view. The problem is that it's not dramatically better. And we see NPR increasingly mirroring the worst characteristics of broadcast media. And that's something that ought to be guarded against. The problem is that NPR is dramatically reliant on corporate giving and corporate support, which is a challenge. I mean, it undermines both the credibility of the institution and also, to my mind, its ability to do the work that it should. Look to the British model, where you see the BBC fully funded by a tax on television sets, essentially a public stream of money. And that better source of funding leads to a dramatically better news and information gathering operation. That's what we ought to be looking for in the U.S. We ought to be looking for ways to reform NPR. We shouldn't want to get rid of it because it is one of our vehicles for creating a better media. But we should be skeptical, critical, and much more demanding of it.
John, we have a hotbed of listeners in Homewood, Illinois. We have another one now just called in. Line 4, Homewood, Illinois, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah, hi. Back on the Iraq issue, with the current White House statement saying that their mind hasn't been made up whether to actually start a war, do you think there's a possibility that he might, this might all blow over?
Yeah, I think there is a possibility. I wouldn't guarantee it, though. I mean, one of the things is it sort of depends on how skeptical you are. If you're really skeptical, if you're really cynical, you might come to believe that the Bush administration hyped the whole thing up as an election issue, and that once the election is decided, the Bush folks will quickly recognize that they don't want to get into the quagmire of Iraq, and they will let the issue die away. I'm not entirely in that camp, although I certainly do believe that the issue has been ginned up for the election. The problem I've got with that is that after so much talk about the threat, quote-unquote threat posed by Iraq, I think that the president and some of the people around him are going to have a very hard time moving away from that. And they also may have had their confidence kind of built up by the failure, in my view, of the Democratic leadership to mount an opposition. So I think that the chance of a war remains quite high, although, again, that sort of depends on your level of cynicism.
John Nichols, our guest today on Media Matters. Before we get back to you, John, I want to make a brief announcement. Those of you who would like to get a weekly email update of who's going to be on our show, information about the guests, where websites and other materials, you can learn more about past and present and future guests. Or if you want to communicate with us, it'll give you access to that. You can register to get a weekly email. We won't use it for any other purposes. It won't be given out to anyone else. You'll just get one email a week from us. All you have to do is email us at listproc, listproc, at prairienet.org. listproc@prairienet.org. And then in the message text, just write subscribe, Media Matters, and then write your name. So like John Doe or Bob McChesney or John Nichols. Subscribe, Media Matters, one word, Bob McChesney. listproc@prairienet.org. A lot of people have already done it. We urge you to do so. It'll keep you up to speed on everything that's going on with the show. John Nichols?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot going on in the world today. And you wrote a book, Jews for Buchanan, a great book that was published by the New Press last year. And it was about the Florida race in 2000, what happened there. And I think it was a sort of chilling chronicle of all the misdeeds that were done in tabulating the votes and conducting that election, the severe problems with that election. It gave a lot of talk at the time that there would be tremendous electoral reform in this country, in Florida and nationwide. Has that reform taken place?
No, the reform has not taken place. We, in the last week or so, saw some minimal movement in the House and Senate toward an enactment of a compromise bill, and that will probably happen, which does some reform, but it doesn't begin to impose the national standards that are desperately needed. And this is really one of the biggest issues in any democracy. It ought to be the central issue, and that is assuring that every citizen has both a right to vote and a certainty that that vote will be counted. We do not have such a system in this country today, and despite all of the crises in Florida, as was evidenced by the recent primary mess in Florida, we have not fixed the system. I really have been led to turn toward the wisdom of Congressman Jesse Jackson, Jr., who has proposed a constitutional amendment that would simply say that every American has a right to vote and a right to have that vote counted. Frankly, I think it's what we need, because it is clear that the politicians are not willing or able to fix a system that is desperately out of whack, not just in Florida, but in states like Illinois, which I would note had a higher level of discarded ballots than Florida did in the 2000 election.
And finally, we've only got about a minute left, John, but I'd like to talk about something that's completely fallen from view in the past 2 months since the Iraq war debate has commenced in earnest at the urging of the Bush administration, which is the wave of corporate scandals that really dominated the news for the spring and early part of the summer. And, you know, what has happened to those? What's the nature of the press coverage been of those? And specifically, if you could, just for a second, you know, both the vice president and president, with Halliburton and Harkin, have severely questionable activities of their own with corporate behavior. Are these going to ever come back to the news? What's going on? Why aren't we hearing more about this?
Well, again, it's a media that follows the official sources and the official spin. And so rather than kind of digging into this incredibly meaty story of the corporate connections to our president and vice president, and really to a lot of people in Congress on both parties, media has, you know, been led away by and basically a cheap spin by the administration, and also the failure of Democrats to make this a central issue. And it's really an indictment of our media, because reporters know this is a good story. They know readers want to read about it, and they know it matters a great deal. And yet they are unwilling to take the courageous step of just saying, look, you know, this matters more. This is more interesting. It's a better story than what you're telling us to cover. We're not going to follow the spin. We're going to do what's right. So far, we, in our mainstream media at least, we have a real failure on the part of editors and a lot of journalists to do their job.
John Nichols, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much on short notice for agreeing to be our guest today. You've been wonderful, as always. Our guest, John Nichols. I'm Bob McChesney, your host for Media Matters. I'd like to thank Ben Scott for being producer, and see you all 1 week from today.